This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. With Mint, you can get the coverage and speed you're used to, but for way less money. And for a limited time, Mint Mobile is offering 3 months of unlimited premium wireless service for $15 a month. So while your friends are sweating over data overages and surprise charges, you'll be chilling, literally and financially. Say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans of Mint Mobile come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch the overpriced wireless and get 3 months of unlimited service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. Listen, I'm with one of the big wireless carriers, and it's time to ditch them because my bills are way too high, and it's time to move over to Mint Mobile. So this year, skip breaking a sweat and breaking the bank. Get this new customer offer and your 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month at mintmobile.com/curb. That's mintmobile.com/curb. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 per month. Limited time new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. Fibromyalgia. It's real, and you can treat it. We'll prove it to you on this episode. Welcome to the Curbsiders, the internal medicine podcast that uses expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Watto. On this episode, I won't be joined by my normal co-hosts, Dr. Tony Sideri and Dr. Stuart Brigham. They were on call at Cashlack Memorial, so they weren't around for this interview. But I had a great conversation with our guest, Dr. Daniel Claw. Dr. Claw is a professor of anesthesiology, medicine, and psychiatry from the University of Michigan. He attended undergrad and medical school at Michigan and then did his internal medicine residency and rheumatology fellowships at Georgetown University, where he eventually held roles including the chief of rheumatology and the vice chair of medicine. While at Georgetown, he assembled an interdisciplinary team who began to study the central nervous system contributions to a number of chronic pain disorders, including fibromyalgia, interstitial cystitis, low back pain, and Gulf War illnesses. This group of investigators, the Chronic Pain and Fatigue Research Center, moved to the University of Michigan in 2002. Dr. Claw remains very active in institutional and departmental translational research training programs and is very active and recognized as a mentor of clinical and translational researchers. Many of his mentees are producing research aimed at helping better understand how to best diagnose and treat acute and chronic pain. Dr. Claw now has over 300 peer-reviewed publications and has been the PI of more than $100 million in federal grants. Needless to say, we are thrilled to have him on the show today. We made a connection over Skype, so some of the audio is a little bit choppy in spots, but I feel the content is really good, and I wanted to get it out to you guys. So rather than spend 100 hours on editing, I'm just going to ask you guys to deal with some of those spots. On this episode, we get really deep into chronic pain and fibromyalgia, going through, in part one, the diagnosis, the epidemiology, the pathophysiology of chronic pain. Part two is more geared towards the actual treatment, both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic therapies that are available. I think there's a lot of great clinical pearls in here for our listeners. I think you guys are going to love the episode. So without further ado, here's Dr. Claw. Hi, Dr. Claw.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
You've done lots of research in chronic pain, and I've heard you say that you have a very high pain threshold, and it doesn't seem like you have chronic pain yourself. So how did you get so interested in this topic of all topics?
Well, I'm trained as a rheumatologist, and even though almost all of what rheumatologists see is chronic pain, or at least people present with chronic pain, I was always sort of fascinated by how little we understood about the underlying mechanism of pain. And I saw a lot of patients with fibromyalgia during my rheumatology fellowship. And although the people that were mentoring me didn't know what the pathophysiology was, they actually believed it to be a real entity, and I thought it was just a fascinating condition, so I began working in fibromyalgia pretty early in my career.
And, you know, that's great that the people you were working with believed in it, because I had mentioned to you in pre-recording there that I really, until the past few years, knew very little about this until I was kind of thrown into the fire as a primary care doctor, and sort of like realizing that I did not know enough about this, and the topic of fibromyalgia had been almost like a taboo subject when I was in medical school and residency, so I didn't even know if I should talk to patients about it.
And that's not uncommon. We've learned a lot about fibromyalgia just in the last 10, 15 years or so, and the medical knowledge in the general medical community has not caught up yet. A lot of the advances in fibromyalgia, and even more broadly in chronic pain, could only occur after the advent of research techniques like functional neuroimaging and chemical structural neuroimaging. So that really has been a boon to neuroscience research in general, but also pain research more particularly.
And I definitely want to talk about your research a little later on, but before we get into some of that stuff, I just wanted to ask you, what sort of habits or skills do you think you had to allow you to get so heavily involved and be so successful as a researcher?
I think I'm naturally inquisitive. I think that's one of the reasons that I went into rheumatology. Rheumatology sees a lot of the patients that other people can't really figure out what's wrong with them. But yet it's still a subspecialty that looks at the entire body. And that was one of the things I really enjoyed about rheumatology. And in fact, one of the things that led me early in my career to start to recognize this fibromyalgia phenotype, if you will, not just in people who we diagnosed in fibromyalgia, but in people with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and osteoarthritis that would have this symptom profile in addition to an autoimmune disease. That was pretty compelling to me and quite fascinating as to what the underlying mechanism or mechanisms was for that underlying problem.
Yes, and I definitely want to ask you more about that. So at this point, I want to move into sort of the meat of the talk here. So just to get it out of the way, we kind of been skirting around the topic. So fibromyalgia, should we be telling patients they have it? Is it real? Is it going to harm them if we tell them they have fibromyalgia?
I always tell practitioners that they should use whatever term they feel most comfortable with. So if they don't like the term fibromyalgia, I understand why they might not like it, just because of some historical issues with fibromyalgia. So I don't try too hard to get providers to use the term fibromyalgia. I do get them to try to understand the underlying mechanisms, and most importantly, understand what's going on in that person's body, what in that person's brain, and how you can most effectively help that person with both drug and non-drug treatment.
And I know that you were involved recently in writing a white paper sort of talking about this issue of chronic pain and how we're not doing as well as we could be with it. And I think that had talked about maybe calling it something different that's a little bit more intuitive for people.
Well, we will often use the term centralized pain when we're talking about fibromyalgia, just so that people understand that this type of pain seems to be coming either entirely or largely from the central nervous system, because that is really the most important thing for providers to understand, is that the way that most people learned about pain and the way that acute pain most oftenly presents is what we would call nociceptive pain. There's something wrong out in the peripheral tissues, some damage or inflammation out in the peripheral tissues that activates nociceptors out in the peripheral tissues that sends a signal down the sensory nerves, which eventually propagates all the way up through the spinal cord up into the brain to be felt as pain. And that's nociceptive pain or peripheral pain. A second mechanism of pain, which most practitioners are familiar with, but is not statistically as common, is neuropathic pain. But then the third mechanism is really what I'm going to be talking about and what fibromyalgia is a poster child for, and that's centralized pain, pain where the pain seems to be coming more so from the brain. It's more of a pain amplification or volume control problem in the central nervous system than it is a problem in the area or areas of the body where the person's experiencing pain. And the most important thing about that is that the drug and the non-drug treatments that work well for nociceptive pain, NSAIDs, opioids, injections, surgical procedures, don't work at all for centralized pain. So it really is important to be able to recognize this type of pain, whatever you want to call it, and understand that it's not going to respond to those classic, you know, NSAID, opioid, surgery, injection treatments, and instead you're going to have to use drugs that work in the central nervous system and more aggressively use non-drug therapies like exercise, cognitive behavioral therapies to try to treat that kind of pain.
And you say it here, it sounds so intuitive and practical, but I see patients in my practice, and I forgot to mention to you before we were starting to talk that my actual employer, there would be too much red tape if I use their real name, so we just call the hospital that I work at Cashlack Memorial Hospital, pun intended on the Cashlack. And so at Cashlack, I've seen lots of patients. They carry the diagnosis of fibromyalgia, yet they've had both knees done, both shoulders done, both ankles done. They've had carpal tunnel surgery on both wrists. And that it's kind of led me to think, and they're still coming to me for pre-ops for further surgeries. It's very hard to convince them they don't need it. And I just wonder if surgeons should be helping us intervene here.
Absolutely. And some of the work we've done in the last couple of years, I think has been quite impactful, at least in the surgeons and anesthesiologists that see the data and hear some of this work presented, because we've shown that if you use the new 2011 survey criteria for fibromyalgia, which basically can be scored from 0 to 31, and 0 to 19 of the items are how many sites people have pain in their body, and so you're really looking for how multifocal the pain or how widespread the pain is. Obviously, if the pain is occurring because of a volume control problem in the brain, then it could be in any area of the body, and it's not likely to be just in one or two locations in the body. The other part of that questionnaire asks about other central nervous system symptoms that co-occur with centralized pain, like fatigue, sleep problems, and memory problems. And what we've shown in some recent studies is that that scale goes from 0 to 31. 13 is said to be the cut point for saying that a person has fibromyalgia. But what really is striking is that for each 1 point increase in that scale from 0 to 31, people get less responsive to opioids that are given in the immediate perioperative period in individuals that are getting either their knee or hip replaced. And they're far less likely to get better with respect to their knee or hip pain after arthroplasty, the higher the score is. And this extends well below the threshold of that score that we would use to say someone has fibromyalgia. So this really seems to be like a trait of individuals, an observable trait of individuals. And if you, as a practitioner, get used to looking for this symptom pattern, multifocal pain with fatigue, memory problems, sleep disturbances, you'll start to see people with sub-threshold fibromyalgia all the time. This is just incredibly common. And the more rapidly you start to pick up on the fact that that's what the underlying problem is, a really low dose of a tricyclic drug at bedtime and an exercise program might really do a great job in treating that individual's symptoms. And I think one of the problems with fibromyalgia, quite frankly, is that by the time people get to a score that would lead them to be diagnosed with fibromyalgia, this disease has usually been going on 15, 20, 25 years and either has been untreated or maltreated. And so I think that a lot of what we see with these fibromyalgia patients that none of us can make better is a illness that has gone untreated for 20 or 30 years. And that you know, if you don't treat someone's diabetes for 20 or 30 years, or you don't treat their rheumatoid arthritis for 20 or 30 years, it's really hard to reverse that if you finally start treating it at some much later point in time. And I think that's one of the fundamental messages I have about this concept and about fibromyalgia, is when you see that fibromyalgia patient, it's almost as if it's too late. When that pain is so widespread and it's been going on 15, 20, 25 years, and all the psychological and behavioral comorbidities have settled in, that person should have been treated for this problem, whatever you want to call it, when they began to develop symptoms in their teens or their 20s.
And I think the patients that kind of intimidate physicians are probably the ones that no one caught this early. They're coming in, they're already on narcotics. They might be on benzos for sleep or Ambien, and they're unhappy. They have comorbid psychiatric illnesses by that point. And these patients scare physicians. I mean, we feel bad for these patients, and they make us feel like failures sometimes because they're very difficult to treat.
Well, those patients scare me too.
Oh, that's good to hear.
I shouldn't say that. I mean, there's some people like that that we can make quite a bit better. But what often really happens with those people that leads to them to be very difficult to treat and frustrating to treat is they give up. But they've been beaten down by our system. They've had a lot of unnecessary surgery and injections. If they've been put on opioids or if they have gone on disability, those are two incredibly negative prognostic factors for this spectrum of illness, but there's a lot of those people out there. One of the things that I try to teach residents and fellows, and I think this holds true for anyone taking care of these types of patients, is that when you encounter a patient that's given up and they're not willing to do exercise or cognitive behavioral therapy and they don't want to try any different drugs, there's nothing wrong with you telling that person that maybe you're not the right doctor for them, because you're not going to just give them an opioid, or you're not going to sit there and listen to them complain about how bad they feel when they're not willing to do anything themselves to make their situation better. And, you know, that's not something that I enjoy doing, but it's something that you have to do, or else those three or four patients in your practice will suck the life out of you and won't allow you to have the empathy and the wherewithal to take care of all the other patients that have this problem, that in fact do want to get better. And if you explain this to them and they begin to understand the role they need to play and the types of drugs and non-drug therapies that are going to work, then a lot of these people can get quite a bit better. But it's just harder and harder. The longer they've had this, the behavioral, psychological factors really get fairly firmly entrenched. And that is a big part of what makes these people really difficult to treat.
So getting our listeners to help them diagnose this early, the 2011 criteria you were referring to are the ones that use the widespread pain index and the symptom severity score. And Those are things you can just Google search that document and print out the PDF and give it to your patients, and essentially you can diagnose them that way. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I wrote a review article on fibromyalgia in JAMA in 2014, and it has it's a nice review, I think, in a lot of ways. Not the least of which is it's got a comprehensive table that lists all the evidence-based drug and non-drug therapies and gives people suggestions and hints about what dose to start the drugs on and how to slowly increase them. But that article also has a really nice tear-out version of the 2011 criteria. It was meant by JAMA, made it so that people could pull it out, make copies of it, administer it in clinical practice. And I would really highly recommend when you're seeing a chronic pain patient to give that to them, because it really will tell you a great deal about what the underlying mechanism or mechanisms are in that person's pain. If they score, again, don't be looking for the people that score really, really high, that that meet criteria for fibromyalgia, because you don't need a questionnaire to identify those people. They smack you upside the head when you walk in the exam room. But it's really good at helping identify the sort of sub-syndromal fibromyalgia, the people that wouldn't quite meet criteria. But those are probably the people that are most responsive to treatment, because they haven't moved so far down the continuum that they've really become unresponsive to a lot of the treatments we would otherwise use.
And the way that I've kind of moved to, you can sort of get a flavor for patients when you meet them. You think, okay, maybe this person has fibromyalgia, but really probably what you mean like by that is they have a chronic pain syndrome. There's probably some centralization to this disease, and intervening early is really important. And when you're following these people, are you repeating that questionnaire and seeing if the score changes? Is that a validated way to kind of assess, or do you look at a different marker for how they're doing on treatment?
I do follow that measure, but what I more so follow when I'm following people longitudinally is some measure of functional status, because that's really what we're aiming for when we're treating chronic pain patients, is we're trying to get them to improve and increase their function. We actually don't like having chronic pain patients attend too closely to their pain levels. If you have pain patients attend too closely to their pain levels, that's not as effective with respect to a lot of the cognitive behavioral approaches and rehab approaches as to explain to them is what you need them to do is continue to try to slowly increase their function. And as they get slowly better, whether it's a drug or a non-drug therapy that you use to get them better, that their responsibility is to try to slowly begin to do things that they stopped doing as their pain was getting worse. Start moving more, getting more active, maybe even doing very, very mild, light exercise, something like walking. One of the important things about using exercise to treat chronic pain, which can be extremely effective, is that you have to start at a really low level of it. And for most chronic pain patients, the best thing to do is talk to them about increasing their activity rather than actually doing exercise, because most chronic pain patients are so sedentary that if you use the word exercise, they look at you like you're stupid. But if you instead say, you know, you need to get up every hour and walk for 5 or 10 minutes, you need to be developing a walking program where you begin walking 10 minutes a day, and then you go to 11 minutes, and then you go to 12 minutes, but you have to become more active and then finally get into sort of some daily light exercise. Anyone can do that, but you really have to be quite insistent with your patients that that's an important part of their overall therapy, getting a good night's sleep, trying to reduce stress, some of the other kinds of things that we focus on in the behavioral programs.
I think we're starting to get, people are starting to get the message, at least down here in San Antonio, that they need to be active. And that I've taken on that same practice of telling them you need to be active. I think one good thing about this Fitbit pedometer craze that's going on right now is that a lot of the patients can easily say, okay, I'm going to try to go for, you know, I want to eventually get to 10,000 steps a day. But you can tell a patient with a chronic pain syndrome, if you walk 10,000 steps, you're going to feel wiped out for a few days. So maybe just start at 1,000 or 2,000 steps. And that, I think we're starting to get good results there.
One of the analogies I use for patients is that I actually view exercise as a drug to treat this spectrum of illness. And there's a lot of evidence that it actually is probably working, at least in part, the same way as tricyclic and serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. That exercise is increasing brain neurochemicals like norepinephrine, serotonin, and that leads to increased activity down descending analgesic pathways that go from the brain down to the spinal cord. And the more activity you have down those descending pathways, the less of that nociceptive input from the periphery that is allowed to go upward to your brain to be felt as pain. So just as we now know pretty clearly that tricyclics and SNRIs are working in that way, that probably is how exercise is working. That's probably in part how sleep is working, all by increasing activity down these descending analgesic pathways that are primarily noradrenergic and serotonergic.
I want to take a minute here to answer some listener questions, which had to do with the diagnosis of fibromyalgia, since we're kind of at that point in the talk. So listener Maria from Philadelphia, she said, how do you differentiate fibromyalgia from other processes, other disease processes with similar symptoms? And I think the meaning, kind of the question here is, should we be doing this workup? I see a lot of these fibromyalgia patients coming in with just tons of labs, the rheumatologist's favorite. I'm not saying the rheumatologists are ordering this. I'm saying I see people ordering ANAs and ESR, CRPs on all these folks.
Everyone deserves that workup once. One of the things that can help guide the intensity of the workup is how long the person has had these symptoms. If you see Mrs. Jones, who started out as a teen by having painful menstrual periods and migraines, and in her 20s she had low back pain and temporomandibular joint disorder and some irritable bowel. And then, after a divorce in her mid-30s, the pain became so widespread that someone said it was fibromyalgia. You don't really need to do much of a workup in that person because their history is so classic and there's not anything else that's likely to be. Now, on the other hand, if someone comes in with subacute onset of diffuse myalgias and arthralgias in some fatigue, and that's been present for 3 months, and they don't have that long history of pain in other areas of their body, then the workup of that latter person needs to be a lot more aggressive, and certainly include things like a SED rate, a CRP, perhaps an ANA and a rheumatoid factor. As a rheumatologist, I cringe because those are that you really should only order those if you suspect lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. They're not good screening tests.
My favorite is the 1 to 40 speckled pattern that comes back positive, and the patient somehow gets a hold of that lab and they tell everyone they have lupus, even though they have no other findings of lupus or whatever rheumatologic disease they tell people they have. But I think another point that we should make when we're talking about these labs is that it is possible, right, to have rheumatoid arthritis or lupus and then go on to develop fibromyalgia?
Absolutely. And this is where we even more commonly will use the term centralized pain. We'll say that, you know, this person with rheumatoid arthritis has rheumatoid arthritis as an autoimmune disease, but superimposed upon that, they've centralized their pain. And even if you treat them with the, you know, TNF inhibitors and all the best biologics and bring their inflammation down to normal, they'll still have widespread pain and fatigue and memory problems and sleep disturbances, and you're going to need to treat that like you would fibromyalgia. It seems as though that having ongoing nociceptive input, like an autoimmune disease, like osteoarthritis, like sickle cell disease, will drive this process of central sensitization. And so that seems to be why we see it so commonly in individuals that do have some peripheral nociceptive pain, whether it be low back pain, again, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, lupus, sickle cell disease. All of those conditions have fairly high rates of, whether you want to call it fibromyalgia or call it centralized pain. And you need to recognize that, or else you'll be misled into thinking that all of that pain is nociceptive pain and you'll overuse NSAIDs, opioids, surgical procedures.
And the other listener question that I wanted to ask you, this is from Scotty from Ohio. He asked, is skin biopsy for small fiber neuropathy beneficial or indicated?
No. There are a couple neurologists that have published articles suggesting that there's a finding in the small nerves of the skin that has been called small fiber neuropathy, but most of us in the field don't think that has anything to do with the cause of fibromyalgia and don't think that these individuals should be getting skin biopsies. Again, there's a couple people that would disagree with me, but the overwhelming opinion in the fibromyalgia field and even the broader pain field is that those findings really have nothing to do with what's causing fibromyalgia.
And jumping back to when you are diagnosing, if you're old school and you want to use the tender point exam, is that still something that people are doing or that primary care doctors should even be messing with?
I hope not. I do think if you want to, I think it's helpful to assess people for tenderness on exam. But if you're going to spend the time doing that on an exam, I would strongly recommend that what you do is press in, start on by pressing on someone, the fingers of someone's hand, and press in the interphalangeal region between the joints and then over the interphalangeal joints, and then sort of march up your finger up into that person's forearm. And you can do that in about 5 or 10 seconds to start in the finger and just literally move up into the forearm and do it bilaterally. And you get a really good sense of how tender that person is and how diffuse their tenderness is in way less time than counting 18 tender points. But the other thing I like about using that tenderness exam is that if you do only identify that someone is tender over the joints, then that's the person you should be a little more concerned. They could have an early lupus, early rheumatoid arthritis, that they have some inflammatory process or autoimmune process that might be brewing. Whereas if you find that they're equally tender all the way, or that the tenderness gets more pronounced as you get up into the muscles of the forearm, then that would be what you'd expect to see in someone that had centralized pain.
And I've, in my own practice, I've largely stopped referring these patients to rheumatology unless I'm on the fence about whether or not they have some sort of rheumatologic condition. Is that appropriate? Like if we do the widespread pain index and the symptom severity score, they meet criteria based on that for us to kind of label this fibromyalgia and go on with treatment?
Absolutely. There's not anywhere near enough rheumatologists in the country to take care of all the fibromyalgia. And to be fair, they're not really trained in this. They're trained more in taking care of autoimmune diseases, and that's what they're good at. And so there's some rheumatologists that will care for individuals with fibromyalgia, but I think what most would prefer to do is what you just said, is that if you have a question about whether there might be an underlying autoimmune disease or not, then absolutely send them to a rheumatologist for a one-time consult to make sure there's not an underlying autoimmune disease. And sometimes the rheumatologist might give you some suggestions about management, but I really think general internist primary care physicians are best at managing this problem because it presents in all areas of the body. It's not, if once you figure out that that's what this person has, then, you know, the next time they present with discomfort or pain in another area of the body, you don't have to refer them to a subspecialist. You know what the problem is, and you can really manage that a lot better centrally than by referring them to subspecialists who are in charge of the area of the body where they're experiencing pain. That's often a unsatisfying encounter for both the patient and that subspecialist.
And you're mentioning other areas of the body has me thinking. I'm often seeing these patients, IBS, TMJ, migraine headaches, interstitial cystitis. Are these all part of the same disease process, or is this something different?
They're all the same. The NIH has recently coined a term, chronic overlapping pain conditions, and it really is now thought that the majority of people with conditions like interstitial cystitis, irritable bowel, tension headache, fibromyalgia, that this is really one problem, one brain pain amplification problem that just presents at different areas of the body at different points in that person's life.
Wow. I did not know that. At this point, we've talked a lot about the diagnosis and sort of the background. I definitely want to move on to talking about the treatment of this. And I'm not sure at this point, we'll see if in post we're going to split this into two episodes or not. This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole. You can find show notes, along with links to any articles, books, websites, or apps mentioned on the show at thecurbsiders.com. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and don't forget to leave us a review. This will help others discover the wonderful show. You can contact us on our pages on Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, or you can follow us on Twitter at The Curbsiders. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Watto, hopefully next time with my co-hosts, Dr. Tony Sideri and Dr. Stuart Brigham. Thanks for listening.